Welcome to this, the seventh episode of the British Society of Haematology Lymphoma Podcasts. I'm Bernard Mabry, a haematology trainee in the West Midlands, and I'm pleased to welcome Nick Chavda, a consultant haematologist in Bristol with an interest in lymphoid malignancies, to talk with me today about supportive care in lymphoma. Welcome, Nick. Let's move straight on to our first case, which is a 73-year-old lady who has a scan to investigate weight loss, sweats, and back pain. That shows thoracic and abdominal lymphadenopathy and soft tissue tumours in several of her vertebrae. A biopsy showed diffuse large B-cell lymphoma. Her ECOG performance status is 2, and she was treated with a prednisolone prephase followed by 6 cycles of R-CHOP to a complete response. However, after her 5th cycle, she develops acute back pain, and a scan shows a fracture of L2. This is probably a scenario, Nick, that most listeners can recognise. Are these events just bad luck?
So I think, we're getting increasingly aware of these patients who, we can do quite a lot of mischief for. So I think there's a sort of understanding in, thoughts in lymphoma doctors of people give them some steroids and part of our therapy. And actually, when we sometimes look at our other colleagues around the hospital and certainly some of the patients we give and the dose of steroids we give, whether that is a CHOP dose, prednisone 100 milligrams, or even, in other settings when you're giving dexamethasone 20 milligrams myeloma patients and so forth. There is an understandable toxicity with these agents, especially in older people, but that's a broad view of our patients. We should be thinking about this. And these are events that can be predicted or looked into more. And it's, I think it's come more into the mainstream recently. Been some recent papers that show that, we're looking at the incidence of fractures of around maybe 10% at a year, and maybe sort of 12% to 18 months. I think Toby Ayres published something on that recently, and about 10% of those required surgery overall. So, I think, some of these patients which we're planning to give high dose steroids, in this case, the patient got steroid prephase as well, which is, 5 to 7 days of a reasonable dose steroids, as well as the 5 days of the R-CHOP per cycle. It is worth assessing these patients. And I think those classical risk factors for bone health come into the fray. So obviously weight, have they got evidence of bone involvement by the lymphoma already? Are they somebody who's already got a sort of pre-existing confirmed diagnosis of osteopenia, osteoporosis? And we need to take steps to be able to kind of look at that and manage that preemptively. I think, well, go for things preemptively as well to reduce that risk of fractures in the first line. And then obviously, if things do happen, then hopefully there are going to be services available for patients to be able to do that.
So what
So I
should we
think,
be doing to try to prevent fractures in these patients, do you think?
So I think all these patients, when we're assessing them, they need to have those risk factors aligned. But I think simple things that we were doing, and these are the protocols that we're working up is look at least giving patients, vitamin D therapy, potentially combined with calcium if they're not hypercalcemic as well. And then I think if they've got a multitude of risk factors, the data suggests that giving, a single shot of bisphosphonate like zoledronic acid can be useful as well. So yeah, that's the preventive step in making sure that we're asking about bone health and bone pain throughout therapy. And then I think we need to be very careful about symptoms, especially in the follow-up phase. So especially for high-grade lymphomas and things, we're seeing these patients really for maybe a couple of years, and then they sort of switched over to possibly patient-initiated follow-up. But those are the sort of longer-term sequelae of treatment that we need to be aware of.
Do you think there is a long-term risk associated with that? I mean, obviously the steroids are a temporary intervention, and once you finish therapy and you're a few months out, do they remain at a higher risk of fracture than age-matched patients without lymphoma?
Yeah, I think so. I think they'll get, I mean, it'd be good to see some of the data on people who have had DEXA scan and bone density scans after in sort of age match controlled population and those who've had therapy with steroids. But there are long lasting effects of glucocorticoids on bone health. So I think, we just have to be mindful of that going to the longer term. And a lot of these fractures in some of the papers we're seeing, they're looking out into a year, 2 years post treatment with events still happening. So I think it is worth ensuring that these patients are on appropriate, vitamin D, calcium, and that, that they're aware of that and the GP's aware of that as well. All
Yeah.
these sort of longer term sequelae that we're seeing of of lymphoma patients.
Yeah. I've had patients in myeloma clinics before who with extensive lytic disease who get referred to sort of specialist orthopedic services like the RNOH at Stanmore, and they make custom thoracic lumbar braces to try to prevent patients developing fractures while they're in that initial phase of treatment until they've started to get some bone healing. And I think we've had one or two lymphoma patients treated in a similar fashion. And certainly others with, for instance, extensive pelvic or femoral disease, who we try to minimize weight bearing until they've got some bone healing to reduce that risk of fracture. Have you had any experience of those kind of non-pharmacological approaches?
I think when we've identified high-risk lesions in patients, especially if they cause a sort of major cortical disruption in weight-bearing bones, then that's something that we always think about referring to our surgeons for. Certainly, if they need to have prophylactic pinning to go on board, if there's an imminent risk of fracture or, as you say, non-weight-bearing, I guess, some of the scores they use in the myeloma setting, so the Mirell score and things like that might come into play there about how keen they would be to put in, prophylactic and prospective sort of metal work into these patients if they're at inherent risk of fractures. But I think it's an approach that's kind of very varied. I've tended to find, depending on how keen the local centres are to instigate this, even patients with bone lesions and bracing that we don't come across too much, but I've had sort of other instances in sort of bone related malignancies and sort of histiocytic disorders. It can be quite a chore to get the braces one fitted to the comfortable three, and if they're compliant, they're going to use them. So it kind of can be quite hard.
Okay, and if patients do develop fractures, is there anything that, we as hematologists should be doing differently, or is there anything that other services can offer?
So I think, the recognition, and obviously we make those diagnoses of sort of fractures, depending on what part of their patient journey they are on, during therapy, because that's might well affect the delivery of our treatment, or at least, going to make things slightly trickier. But I think, when we've got to people who have acute fractures, I think referral onto the appropriate service to make sure their GP is well, and obviously go through, send them into specialized osteoporosis or fracture clinics. And I think these days a lot of those are run by rheumatology teams and bone health teams to try and optimize those. Hopefully they would have had some input from us before, and if we're doing our jobs properly with bone health beforehand, with, like I mentioned, vitamin D, calcium, and maybe they would have had a shot of bisphosphonate as well. But acute fractures, they need to be dealt with, especially if it's sort of spinal osteoporotic fractures. I think,
On that
referral to
note,
appropriate services.
do you have much experience of vertebroplasty for these patients post-fracture?
Don't think I do personally, but I know obviously very much used in the myeloma setting, where they can also do radiofrequency ablation as well at the same time when there's lytic lesions present, and then obviously fill them up, balloon them up, and put cement in there at the same time. I must say we haven't come across that in our practice about using it, but I think it'd be always worth talking to the interventionalists to see what their take is on that, because it's an ever evolving field, and some of the interventional radiologists can be quite keen to try and help with preserve structure and function of the spine, as well as sort of pain in the acute setting.
Are there any other sort of side effects from the high steroid burden of lymphoma treatments that you think is often forgotten?
Yeah, and again, this is something that's will come to the fray over the last few years. Again, I suspect some of our other medical colleagues will be sort of horrified of possibly the amount of steroids that we use. The sort of side effects very commonly seen that we warn about is sort of hyperglycemia with steroid effects and steroid therapy. So, we sort of consent these agents could nudge people who are already in that pre-diabetic range into full-blown diabetes, and certainly those patients who've got properly diagnosed diabetes can make their glycemic control much worse whilst they're on the steroids. So that's just something to think about. And again, it's one of those prompts that, locally we tend to perform baseline HbA1c's for patients, and anybody who's got a HbA1c in that sort of, who isn't diagnosed diabetes but in that pre-diabetic range, we try and flag up to our diabetic support nurses, and maybe even if they're not available, even to the local practices, to see if they can monitor their sugars throughout therapy. And those patients who are known diabetics on all hypoglycemic agents or insulin, again, they should be taking have a much higher sort of surveillance and be in touch with their team closely, because they're going to have quite labile sugars, especially for those days of steroids and not. So that's a tricky one sometimes to manage.
Okay, thanks. Let's move on to our second case, which illustrates some other issues. This is a 59-year-old man who was diagnosed with advanced stage follicular lymphoma, a grade 2, with bulky disease obstructing one of his ureters. He was treated with obinutuzumab and bendamustine. On day 11 of his first cycle, he was admitted to hospital with a temperature of 39.1 and rigors. His neutrophil count was 0.1 at that time, and he developed hypotension, refractory to IV fluid, and required vasopressors. I think infection is still the commonest complication of lymphoma therapy, despite the increasing use of drugs which are not typically considered to be cytotoxic. After all, we do see prolonged neutropenia with lenalidomide, with the antibody drug conjugates, and post-CAR T-cell therapy. The TEAM trial reported a few years ago in myeloma that the use of early prophylactic antibiotics reduced early deaths from infection. Is there anything we should be doing in the lymphoma population to reduce the risk of infection with chemotherapy?
So I think it's a tricky question. I guess, you know, infections with therapy are always one of my most reported adverse events. If you look at any of our trials, you know, neutropenia and infection are always highly up. But neutropenic fever obviously is an emergency where we counsel our patients very carefully for that. At the first whiff of sort of feeling unwell, fevers, temperatures at home, they need to have, you know, 24-hour access to a centre. In terms of prophylaxis against that, it's fairly tricky, isn't it? So I know, you know, from our myeloid colleagues, there's an established sort of working of prolonged periods of neutropenia, you know, at least over a week, where they're giving prophylactic G-CSF to try and hasten count recovery or even potentially try and reduce nadirs. And I think with us, you know, with our chemotherapy cycles, traditionally sort of given every 3 to 4 weeks, we're predicting that they're going to be neutropenic in that sort of middle week or two and trying to give G-CSF prophylaxis for that. A lot of studies have shown that we can possibly decrease the risk of neutropenia, febrile neutropenia, but there's not so much data out there of whether that actually changes the amount of infections they get overall. So they might not be neutropenic anymore, but certainly the amount of infections may not be too dissimilar. So I think it's quite hard to know what that means in context. It might be us making ourselves feel better. Certainly, I don't think there was any data we know of at the moment of prospectively giving people 3 months worth of levofloxacin like the TEAMS trial did, where they showed, you know, there was a sort of good reduction from 27 to 20% infections, and that was because we know mortality, at least in myeloma, was a big it was one of the biggest causes of early deaths in that population. And I think, you know, in COVID, various strategies of trying to be a bit more permissive about using G-CSF in the first line setting, and certainly NICE, some of the guidelines, they talk about the risk of certain, whatever regimens have got a higher risk of inducing neutropenia that you can consider giving higher risk patients, maybe older patients or patients that have had other lines of therapy or have got background bone marrow suppression anyway, primary G-CSF prophylaxis to cover them for that nadir period. Certain studies have shown that it can reduce the sort of the amount of neutropenia that you see and maybe mortality, but in a non-significant way, you know. And I think we, you know, we were in the midst of COVID giving even people Cipro prophylaxis sometimes when they were, the neutrophil count dipped less than 0.5 along with the G-CSF as well. But I think the data for that is pretty scanty, but certainly it's become our practice to be more permissive these days, especially with older patients, I think, or patients, you know, with other lines of therapy who might have a more fragile marrow, to give them G-CSF prophylaxis to try and reduce that risk of neutropenia.
What about sort of specific infections like pneumocystis or viral reactivation?
Yeah, so you know, those regimens that contain sort of especially T cell depleting agents, bendamustine, we're pretty used to giving cotrimoxazole prophylaxis or pentamidine. They can't tolerate those, so that's quite a common prophylaxis that we give. And, you know, and even in settings when they're having autografts and allografts for lymphoma, we tend to do that. They get cotrimoxazole prophylaxis for 6 to 12 months post until their lymphocyte count has recovered to a certain degree before we'd stop that. Locally, at least, our confirmed rate of PJP infection is pretty low, and we're pretty used to giving that. But obviously, that's the offset, I guess, with cotrimoxazole, as it is myelosuppressive. So there's always a bit of a twist there when people are getting low counts and sometimes slight reticence to continue on with giving them cotrimoxazole prophylaxis is going to push down their marrow as well.
What about vaccination? Any role for that in sort of lymphoma therapy? I know it's much better established and well practiced in CLL.
Yeah, I mean, it depends on how brisk your presentation is. So, you know, for those acute cases of high-grade lymphomas, the time to try and get any sort of preemptive workup, you know, sort of vaccinations in is going to be very difficult because they're going to be ablating their immune system essentially with combination chemo-immunotherapy. You know, as you mentioned, sort of CLL is more established immune precedence, and certainly the CLL Support Association have got sort of well-trodden guidelines on giving patients, you know, pneumonia vaccinations with Prevnar, Pneumovax, Shingrix, COVID boosters, and on. but I don't think that's well established for our lymphoma patients, and certainly not something that we do as standard if there's a new diagnosis, you know, if there's got a sort of incidental low-grade, low-stage follicular lymphoma. We don't tend to have extra vaccinations of note. We just make sure that they are vaccinated and up to date as possible with their GPs.
Just encouraging them to get their annual flu vaccine and pneumovax if they're eligible for that, or shingles vaccines.
Yeah, I think if they're eligible, you know, obviously the guidance for that has changed a little bit as well with the Shingrix vaccination, although it's based on risk of immune compromise. But that used to be in the population over 70s, and now from this September, it's gone down to 50 and above, which has been actually very useful for some of our patients with lymphoma, but obviously primarily lots of patients with CLL lymphoid disorder. Again, I think, you know, pneumonia vaccinations, if they can have a pneumovax done every 5 years, if the GP allow it, that's fine. But I think, again, the guidance on that is kind of sketchy.
Okay, so let's move on to a 38-year-old Malaysian man with chronic kidney disease who was admitted from his GP with fevers, weight loss, and an abdominal mass. A CT scan showed soft tissue masses in the mesentery and mediastinal lymphadenopathy. His LDH was 3 times the upper limit of normal, and following an urgent core biopsy, which ultimately showed a peripheral T-cell lymphoma, he was given a course of oral prednisolone. And that was covered with rasburicase at a prophylactic dose and cautious intravenous fluid in view of his CKD. Unfortunately, the following day, the patient developed brisk intravascular hemolysis, requiring 3 units of red blood cells and associated with an acute kidney injury. The diagnosis of oxidative hemolysis was confirmed after G6PD levels were tested on his pre-transfusion sample. What, Nick, would you say are the priorities when you are trying to predict and prevent tumour lysis syndrome?
So, you know, this is predicated on our lymphoma therapies working very well, and obviously that tumour debulking having to be excreted by the kidneys. And again, a lot of that work is recognising those higher risk patients at the start. So we know that, you know, disease that's particularly bulky, disease subtype which has got a high proliferative rate, so things like Burkitt's or high-grade B-cell lymphoma, probably possibly predicted with very high LDH levels in the blood, can be kind of useful predictive markers. But also on the patients themselves, what's their baseline renal function beforehand, and obviously their electrolyte balance before we even start up. So we need to look at that very carefully, and obviously balance that with the sort of effectiveness of our therapies and how abrupt they're going to be. Of course, the sort of response you might get in somebody, you know, having DRC combination for a disease like Waldenstrom's, not going to have the same potential effect of TLS than somebody with Burkitt's going straight up to R-CoDX-M, R-IVAC. So it's going to be a combination of, you know, the disease risk factors, the patient sort of type as well, and obviously the sort of debulking potential of the therapy that we're giving these patients. So I think there are categories and risk strategies to look at this. And again, that was published in the BSH guidelines a little while ago to work out what regimens people would be more concerned about. But I think if there is some concern of a patient having a lot of bulky than a proliferative disease with therapy that's going to potentially be very rapidly debulking, then we would try and get those patients probably to have, you know, their first cycle of therapy, even if it's outpatient, as an inpatient, perhaps with some preemptive hydration beforehand, possibly tumour lysis bloods twice a day in that first couple of days whilst they're having the therapy to keep a close eye on it, and then look at hyperuricemic medications. Now, classically, that can be anything from allopurinol at 300 milligrams, and certainly most of our patients with high-grade lymphomas will get allopurinol for the first cycle or two and stop when that's when the most of the debulk has happened. But in patients with particularly high risk of TLS, then, you know, we switch over to rasburicase as uric acid oxidase inhibitor. And so that can be used in the treatment setting. And when you've got established TLS, so, you know, from the Cairo Bishop classification, give them full dose rasburicase daily and monitor renal function to actually a well-worn, trot-out prophylactic dose of 3 milligrams per day of rasburicase, you know, in the setting of if they haven't got TLS, but there is a higher risk of that than prophylactic rasburicase, 3 milligrams, I think, is a sensible option for these patients.
So you wouldn't use the licensed dose for prophylaxis in any setting?
In the preemptive stage, you say, if they haven't got established... I think if they're really teetering on the edge, you possibly might have more of an idea to be maybe given that first dose.
I mean, some people are starting to lyse before you've started treatment, aren't they?
Yeah, so I think those people who've already got a phosphate that's creeping up, perhaps potassium that's going on, the creatinine's already on the way, I may be tempted to give that high dose if it's already started. But I think those patients who are pretty pristine in terms of their renal function already, albeit with the mass is pretty bulky, I think make sure they're well hydrated and giving that 3 milligram dose with plenty of time beforehand. They need to give them a few hours at least before we start giving the treatment.
And
then
say,
I think, you know,
you say well hydrated, is that merely euvolemic, or do you aim for kind of hyperhydration and forced diuresis as a preemptive measure?
I'd say pretty euvolemic. I don't think I've ever gone the concept of giving people hyperhydration in this setting with diuresis to try and facilitate that. You know, the only sort of times we think about that sort of hydration, diuresis, you know, in the sense of the methotrexate clearance and CNS prophylaxis, try and clear the drugs. But I think beforehand, you know, I think just reasonable IV fluid hydration, be it, you know, a litre over sort of 8 hours or so, as long as their cardiac function's okay, to try and help excrete that out. But, you know, again, on the flip side of giving people lots of hydration is that some of our patients are going to be older, despite having normal echocardiograms and ventricular function, you don't want to push them into overt pulmonary edema during therapy as well. So it's a bit of a balancing act.
And is there evidence that rasburicase itself actually improves clinical outcomes?
Yeah, it's a tricky one, isn't it? So I think it's one of those things that we always do and makes us feel better. But I don't think there's been any evidence of any sort of randomized controlled trials to say whether rasburicase reduces the risk, you know, or the long-term outcomes of patients in terms of overall survival.
Or even rates of AKI or rates of dialysis or closer surrogates of tumour lysis.
No, I don't think there's any data on an outcome on that of patients being spared that. It's tricky, isn't it? We sort of do it and we manage those electrolyte disturbances. We have had cases of tumour lysis that have quite renal intervention when they've had, you know, good going tumour lysis syndrome fairly abruptly. Now, I don't know if anecdotally giving them rasburicase at home would have stopped it, but I don't think there's any overt data that's ever predicted that or shown that there's a major outcome from that.
Yeah. And I suppose the other thing is the thing not to do, which is replacing the calcium too keenly.
Yeah, precipitate that out with the phosphate going up, yes.
Yeah, trying to hold your nerve as the calcium sinks lower. Well, thanks, Nick. I think it's an interesting set of cases we've talked about. There's a whole load of aspects of supportive care that we haven't touched on in lymphoma. Mood disorders, anxiety and depression associated with cancer survivorship, GI tract side effects, microbiota, and there's a burgeoning literature on that, and the chemotherapy-induced neuropathies, pain management, transfusion support. But obviously, time is. Perhaps we can do more on this in future episodes of the podcast. So thanks very much for your time, and I look forward to talking to you again soon.
Cheers.